Welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy, a journalist of health, food, and the environment, and every week on this program, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and what's going on in your community and our society. Our health is connected to the earth, water, air, and communities we live in. It's not something we can just seek and attain as individuals. So every week on Connect the Dots, we talk to different experts, advocates, authors, thought leaders, advocates, activists, about all the things that we need to be aware of to protect our health and life on Earth. This week, I'm very excited to have a guest on the show who really, for me personally, was the beginning of a lot of this and helped me transition from being someone who just reported on individual health and well-being to really looking at what we're doing as a society and how that impacts all of us and what we can do to make our society healthier, more ecologically sustainable, and just plain not crazy and sort of sane and caring. Our guest today is Josh Fox. Many of you know him as the director of the Oscar-nominated film Gasland 1 as well as Gasland 2. This past year, he's been running the Solutions Tour, which I saw and participated in New York City, going out all over the country to engage in local communities. His work and his films have inspired a regional, national, and even international grassroots advocacy among many people in many different regions working locally and connecting globally to stop fracking and to stall and reverse climate change. He's a leading environmentalist, a talented artist, and really the leader of the pack for people who care in so many ways. I'm so thrilled to have you with us today on the show, Josh.
Thank you. That was a really very flattering introduction. I appreciate your description of this as not crazy.
Well, you know, just to, you know, back when I heard about fracking in 2008, Josh, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but I thought, as a media person, I thought, oy vey, somebody is going to have to really get on the stick and draw this to public attention. And, of course, as a media person, I was like, is that me? You know, and then I heard of someone named Josh Fox who was out making a film. And that was the film that later became Gasland. And when I heard that, I thought, really, right the first I ever heard of it, I thought, well, oh, this is much easier. Little did I know. All I have to do is promote what he's doing and support what he's going on with and help more people know about it. And so that really got me started into much more big picture thinking about what we need to protect everyone's health.
Thank you for doing that. I mean, it was from the very, very beginning, that film, Gasland, really belonged to everybody because it was a film that featured people who were outspoken in their communities about what was happening to them because of fracking and because of drilling. And, you know, when we first started making that movie, we had no delusions that it would ever get anywhere. We only thought it was a project for our community in the Upper Delaware. We thought that it was going to be useful, you know, to people in regional areas that were looking at these drilling questions. We didn't think that it was going to become this huge international, you know, phenomenon with, you know, millions of viewers all over the world. And so when we didn't even wait for it to really be finished. We showed it in segments as we were completing them. So we showed, you know, the piece about New York, the piece about Pennsylvania, a piece about Wyoming, a piece about Texas, and a piece about public health. And we really, when we had, you know, 10 minutes, we showed 10 minutes. When we had 40 minutes, we showed 40 minutes. And we kept it in a conconversation with the movement. And in fact, contrary to the rules of Sundance and other things, I think there were a lot of bootleg copies of early segments of that film that went out into communities on DVD that people, pirated themselves. In fact, at a rally at one point in Albany, somebody handed one to me. So I was like, it was really a film that belonged to everybody. It was taken by the grassroots, and it was a grassroots movement that made it successful. So I'm very grateful to that.
Well, I think that both in terms of raising the profile of this topic, which I remember what the profile was pre-Gasland, right? In terms of raising the profile and concerns over the many, many risks of fracking, pipeline infrastructures, and indeed, all fossil fuel contributors to climate change, you and that film have, and the films and all your work have done a really amazing job. In addition, you've really modeled, that film nourished the work of many local advocates in many different areas, and you really modeled a bottom-up approach that people, talked about, but dreamed might exist. But you actually, your work and the work of our community provide a really concrete, practical example of how this can work, even against, really major forces. And, the forces that we're up against haven't gotten any smaller, although they're experiencing some setbacks in the desire to, bring out of the ground all different kinds of extreme extraction fuels. But they're still there. We have a Republican Congress. So, we still need those tools and those lessons. So I hope we can also talk about that a little bit in this show. Most recently we've had the mind-blowing miracle of the fracking ban in New York State. Let me just first ask you what your reaction was when you first heard that that was going to happen. That was happening. The governor had finally decided.
If I might, though, address your first point, which is I think mm-hmm. that the movement has always been bottom up because that really is the only option at first. And then there are elements of it that really become top down, because I think in New York there was, there were a lot of people in New York City who were concerned about the watershed, and there were a lot of people who lived in the Upper Delaware River Basin and in the Catskill Mountains that had access to resources and the media, and that it is a really beloved area of the country that we're talking about on the chopping block, where a lot of people live. So things are bottom up first because that's what you have access to, right? At the same time, though, I do think that it was evidence of how art and storytelling can really aid science and grassroots work, right? So we're all working together in that aspect. But even before Gasland became a big movie, there were other films that split a state, and there was a film called Rural Impact or something like that. And people would use video work and narrative storytelling. In fact, the Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, at the very first meeting I ever went to on fracking, made short films from Western Pennsylvania with Ron Gula, the people in Washington County, who were telling their stories. And it was storytelling and video work that was helping to push all these things along at the same time. But with the ban, I was in the Amazon. I was actually had been in the Amazon rainforest in the jungle for 5 days, and I was filming my new film on climate change. And I was coming out of the jungle for the first time in that period of like 5 days, and getting first cell phone signals from passing cell phone towers, I started to get messages from a friend of mine. One of them said, "Oh, Zucker did that well." And I was like, "What is going on?" And so I'm getting like 3 text messages at a time as we pass the cell phone tower, and then there's nothing. Then we pass another one, and then there's nothing. And I'm starting to piece together these messages and saying, tell me what's happening. Like, there's a Cuomo press conference. Okay, what's going on? And finally, after like 25 minutes, I texted this friend of mine. I said, "Did we just win?" And she says, Absolute. Well, there was an expletive in the middle of absolutely. Like, she was like, we just won hands down, like, and then it took a few hours to really understand the completeness of what had just happened, because to gain a ban, a total ban, on the grounds of public health, I think and science, public health concerns and science that was motivated and pursued by the grassroots from the beginning, that was, you know, the gold medal. That was the absolute goal, because this was the issue. The issue was, this is going to impact people's health, and we have the science to prove it. And that the major government of New York State, which wasn't anti-fracking, which was at many, many times very pro-fracking, coming around to the conclusion that, yes, the people were right, science was right, and that this was something very, very concerning, was really important. At the same time, and so, you know, hats off to the democratic process in New York State, started by Governor Patterson, followed through by Governor Cuomo, Commissioner Marchand, Pete Granis, the other commissioner of the DEC. These people, who we hammered away at, who were the constant subject of scrutiny and protest and urging and passionate, they responded. They came through, and it is an example of how grassroots democracy and government at the highest level of a state can work together with the media and with art. So, you know, I am very proud that that is the way this went. That is the way this question should go in every other state.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, it is not the way it has gone in most other states. And the big difference is that New York State decided that, you know, high-volume hydraulic fracturing was something new, and they needed to study it before they approved it. And that meant doing an environmental impact study. And other states just were like, okay, oil and gas, money, okay, fine. We don't care if the citizens are at risk. Roll out the red carpet for the frackers. That's what Pennsylvania did. That's what West Virginia did. That's what Texas did. That's what Wyoming did. That's what New Mexico did. That's what's been happening all across this country. New York decided that it was more responsible, and this was way back in the Patterson administration, right? It was better for our citizens to have a firm grasp on what this new thing was. And they did a scoping process. That scoping process allowed citizens to comment. When citizens get to comment, their concerns are public. We have open forums. People listen to each other. They learn. It's democracy at work. And those public forums, those scoping process hearings were grueling. There were 6-8 hours. I remember taping the entire hearings. Oh, my God, you wanted to leave that high school gymnasium so badly. But everyone was there waiting for their turn and learning from each other. And that went on and on and on. I mean, that went on for 7 years until finally the things that people were saying at the very first hearings were adhered to and listened to.
Yeah, you know, and I actually want to pick up on one thread of what you said there, because what often happens is that in a lot of these media controversies where there's PR weigh-in from prominent industries, there's like a question of the science versus the people, right? So either the people are stupid or wrong, or the science is, you know, a kind of wicked invention of somebody. But in this case, as it turned out, the people and the science were actually on the same side. And one of the things that I experienced as a reporter and watching all the media that was, you know, being done throughout these many years on this topic is the people actually had a better grasp of the science than a lot of media reporters did, because they were subject to a lot of industry PR.
The other reason is that, you know, when your life is on the line, and your home is on the line, and your kid's health is on the line, you're not only going to miss, you know, their soccer game on a Thursday night to go to a scoping hearing, you're also going to, like, when a new scientific report comes out, that's your lifeblood. That you're going to seize upon that. I remember when the early reports from Duke University came out that demonstrated that, you know, fracking had impacted water wells, and that methane was 17 times higher in areas where there was fracking and drilling than in non-fracking drilling areas. And I remember when Al Armendariz's first reports in Texas came out, demonstrating that there was an enormous problem with air pollution in the Barnett Shale because of the drilling industry. These reports, and I remember the Hazen and Sawyer report that came out in the Bloomberg administration in 2009 that said fracking and drilling would be a catastrophic risk to the New York City watershed. These were reports that people jumped all over because all of a sudden their concerns were substantiated in scientific form, and they could use that. And information was truly at that point was power. And, you know, what we've seen is an explosion of the science. We have now 415, 400, something like that, over 400 peer-reviewed scientific reports, the vast majority of which back up the citizens' fears and the reporting in Gasland. 90-some-odd percent of them show you that air pollution is a huge problem. 90-plus percent of them show you that health concerns are valid, that there will be health risks in drilling areas. 75-plus percent of them show you that there will be water problems where there's fracking and drilling. These are really substantive peer-reviewed reports, and we have one of them coming out per day. I mean, that was not the situation in 2008.
Right.
In 2008, we had a few people in Wyoming, a few brave people in Texas, a few brave people in western Pennsylvania who were screaming at the top of their lungs, hoping that someone would pay attention to them. You know? And that citizen effort pushed the science. That grassroots mobilization pushed our institutions to investigate this topic. And you're right, though, the media gets tons of PR from the industry, and what their intention is to confuse the public by pretending that there's a debate. Mm-hmm. If the media can pretend, if the industry can say, oh, well, these reports are only one side of it, as if science is only one side of it, as if gravity was only one side of it, right? As if somehow, like, the corporation could come and say, well, we don't believe in gravity, so therefore we can levitate at this moment. You know, and the media just goes, well, we don't know. We're not experts. We're just going to sit here and say the facts are being debated while one side is obviously lying. And that delays things. And it delayed this decision for years, I think.
Well, actually, what's happened with changes in the media is that citizens have to be experts. Citizens have to become experts. And I think Gasland is a great model of that happening and the whole fractivist community. Citizens have become the experts now.
We think of Gasland as a gateway drug, you know. It's a fun movie. You know, it's not hard to digest. It's a road film. It shows a great portrait of America. It shows incredible people. It has, you know, really inspiring and fun and funny weird moments in it. And the fact that it was very popular really helped, I think. But I think it was like a gateway into further study on fracking for people. It was an entrance point certainly for me in these issues as a whole. And I think that it's a gateway into learning about the climate. Because certainly we have to acknowledge the fact that this win in New York is nothing unless we win a lot of other places, virtually every place else. We could win in New York against fracking, we have, as we have in the Upper Delaware River Basin as well, and lose everything we love about New York State to climate change. And I don't need to tell people what happened with Sandy, Hurricane Sandy, or what happened with Hurricane Irene upstate, or the things that are to come which will make life miserable for decades, if not for centuries, if we don't start to reverse the process or stall the process of climate change. I mean, you know, New Yorkers, let's not forget, drowned in their own homes in the Rockaways, in Sheepshead Bay. This was a situation of utter tragedy and caused an estimated $50 billion in damages. These are the things that climate change are the consequences, and New York City is one of the most vulnerable cities economically to climate change. We are on the front lines of that fight in New York. When we're talking about the health of our forests in the Catskill Mountains, in the Upper Delaware River Basin, these are things that are extremely vulnerable to migrating parasites that are moving up the coastline as it gets warmer. We don't want to see that kind of devastation in our lifetimes, and or in our children's lifetimes, or in our grandchildren's lifetimes. And if we're going to really solve that problem, we need to be just as mobilized and just as active on climate as we were on fracking, as we are on fracking, I should say.
How do you think we're doing in terms of the public getting informed and the public getting mobilized on those fronts? Because, you know, I think a lot of people are concerned, but there's also, I detect among some a sense of, well, that's very, very far off. So, you know, if I do anything today, you know, if I make this a priority now, I'm kind of just like a saint, because it's really not on my own behalf, and maybe it's on, you know, for the many hundred centuries down in the future that any of this could become problematic.
Well, first of all, we're not, you know, we have this remarkable capacity to put things off. You know, we're human beings are like the best procrastinators, you know what I mean? Like, I know I feel that way too. I'm a creature born of deadlines. But, you know, we have to start to figure it out. Here's the main thing. We just built, and we are building with fracking, one of the greatest grassroots movements that's ever happened on the planet. And we're not going to just say, oh, you know, the only benefit to that was stopping fracking. That's certainly not the case. There was a, you know, we were also fighting for our own democracy,
right.
And we are fighting for our democracy. And these questions of climate lead us back in many ways to the fundamental issues of economics and democratic participation in this century. I mean, the very forces that seek to continue to dump carbon and methane into the atmosphere are the ones that are trying to deprive us of our basic democratic representation in government. The Koch brothers are the sponsors of the Citizens United decision. These forces are not just forces of the winds of climate change. They're the winds of tyranny. And that is another piece of this question. Whether or not folks are going to be motivated when they don't have the immediate threat of some horrible, stinking, toxic gas well with a waste pit in their backyard is something that we're going to find out. You know, is this work going to be easier or harder now that we don't have the crisis in New York, for example? I know that a lot of other states are currently really re-inspired by what happened in New York and are going, let's go, you know, we can win now. I'm seeing that happen in Pennsylvania. I'm seeing that happen in a lot of other states. And I think that's going to be a very important thing for me to do is go to PA, which, by the way, is where I live. I mean, I live in Pennsylvania. I live a mile from the New York border. So these two states, their fates have always been in a conversation, but it has very much been, you know, the opposite type of the way that this has been handled. Pennsylvania is now a disaster area of fracking ills. Radioactive streams that have been located in Western PA, fracking wastewater, getting into public drinking water supplies, shutting down the entire city of Pittsburgh's drinking water and putting them on a water advisory. In fact, a report came out today that showed ammonia and iodide in very high, too high concentrations in public drinking water supplies in Pennsylvania as a result of drilling waste, fracking wastewater, hitting rivers, methane migration like crazy, scarring of the state forests. It's a disaster area, and it has to be dealt with, and not only dealt with in the sense of stopping the fracking now, but also reparations and repair and trying to restore the dignity of that landscape and trying to somehow figure out how to get those chemicals out of the water, which is going to be very, very difficult to figure out.
It's so ironic, Josh, because your work, along with the work of the entire grassroots community, has really, you know, won the win in New York, and yet as a Pennsylvania resident, you're in one of the states suffering the worst affliction, as you point out, from having, you know, green-lighted all of this. So, you know, you can see the ill effects. And these, you know, which you just cited, also these don't just stop at one border. You know, rivers flow, air streams flow, and pipelines, travel. Transporting the gas. So, you know, everyone always kind of, on the one hand, people get motivated because it's happening in their backyard, but on the other hand, everyone's backyard is connected. And, you know,
I have to feel some sense that it's possible that you're going to win. I mean, part of the problem with Pennsylvania, the only, look, Pennsylvania, organized just as hard as New Yorkers. They're just as super smart. They're just as passionate. And they care just as much about their environment as New Yorkers. Mm-hmm. But they've been banging their head against the wall of the Corbett administration for the last 4 years and the Rendell administration for the 3 years before that. Mm-hmm. Administrations which were pretty much wholly owned subsidiaries of the gas industry. With a small, you know, blip at the very end of the Rendell administration, which said, oops, we might look at this. You know, like, this has been a government that's been openly hostile to its people. Luckily, Tom Corbett is the first Pennsylvania governor in history to be thrown out, incumbent in the modern era. And we have a new governor named Tom Wolf, who is not saying the right things on fracking so far, but we have to start to educate him. And that's the issue is, you know, like, now we have a lot more tools at our disposal than we did in 2008. And those are 400 some odd peer-reviewed papers and a movement that's maturing and understanding its own tactics better and strategies better. So, yes, there may be hope in Pennsylvania yet to reverse some of this process, but now it's about how do we clean up and fix the state? This place is a mess.
That's a cautionary tale as well. What would you see, I mean, basically in this conversation, in terms of what the front lines are, obviously, you know, to really look at the effects and turn things around in Pennsylvania is a high priority. To really look at the flow of money in politics and to really look at the, you know, the global effects of climate change, you know, for which, you know, one win in one state is not going to, it's going to be a great poster child and encouragement for others. It's built a movement that can continue fighting. It has a lot of positives, but we're not all the way home. What would you like to see as the, you know, the sort of top focal point priorities? And what are you working on, you know, coming
up
next?
You can't fight climate change, first of all, without stopping fracking.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't fight climate change with regulation. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen. You're going to have to take the fossil fuel industries on head on. You're going to have to say, thank you very much for 100 years of progress, but we really have to move in another direction now because the next 100 years of fossil fuels, we're going to dismantle everything that we built. And I'd like to see President Obama own up to that fact and own up to the fact that we're in the middle of the greatest grassroots climate movement and grassroots anti-fracking movement and grassroots environmental movement that's existed in 40 years. And you know, the president just came out today with new regulations to limit methane leakage in natural gas production. And I think their ambition is seeking to make fracking climate-friendly. That completely ignores not only the science, which says you can't really solve these problems, but also the imminent environmental crisis that people in America are facing in their backyards with fracking. And it is really unfortunate. I mean, Obama should know in his own climate agreement with China, which is amazing. I must give him praise for this climate agreement with China. But in that agreement, the Chinese agreed to build 800 to 1,000 gigawatts of renewable energy power by 2030. That's an entire United States worth of power. It's like China saying, we're going to build all of the U.S.'s power in renewable energy in the next 15 years. Now, that means to me that we should be able to do the exact same thing. Right?
Yeah.
Not be giving regulations to the fracking industry, but rebuilding our entire power infrastructure. And I bet you we could do it faster than the Chinese could do it. I bet you we could do it in 10 years if we wanted to. Mm-hmm. Now, why doesn't Obama use his last 2 years in office by actually telling the truth about these things and saying this is what we need to do if we're going to solve this climate problem? Because the Chinese have just admitted that they're going to do that. Why don't we be the world leader in this? You know, I guarantee that would cause a lot of confrontation, no question, in America. But that's the kind of political confrontation. That's the kind of discussion we need to be having, not whether or not we should. Look, what does this mean, stopping methane emissions. This means fixing every single gas line in America. That's an infrastructure project that's going to cost billions of dollars to further cement the use of a resource which we need to retire. It makes no sense. It's only because the fossil fuel industry is saying we need to do this. And that's where they're pulling the strings. So that's what I'd like to see. And, you know, that's going to be vital to these questions going forward.
Hmm.
But and I'm working on the climate, to just answer your question. And it is really the third film in the trilogy. It is, you know, it's not a Gasland 3, but it is really the evolution of my understanding of these issues to point me in that direction. The first film being about localized contamination in Gasland, the second film really being about the government and these questions in much more in depth, right? If you want to find out how the Obama administration has handled this question and Congress, really watch Gasland 2. And this third film goes all around the world and deals with people fighting climate change. And I think it's going to be very, very inspiring because it's been very inspiring to make it so far.
That sounds fantastic. Do you have any time frame for, you know, the film's completion? Or because I know things.
Actually, we're going out on the road to do the Solutions Grassroots Tour,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to be showing clips of the film starting in February. We're going to do it like we did the first movie. We're going to show pieces, and we're going to get audience reaction, and we're going to do that all the way through the summer wherever we go. So. When you see the solutions, go to solutionsgrassroots.com. At solutionsgrassroots.com, you can both sign up for alerts, but you can also sign up for renewable energy right there. You can click on the options there to go renewable and buy renewable energy power from a power provider in your area, or you can use it to get solar panels on the roof of your home. But Solutions Grassroots Tour is coming through New York and PA in February and March.
Great.
Alongside Zephyr Teachout, who's going to be coming with us, who's
great.
Terrific. We're going to be going out there and talking about renewable energy, talking about what we need to do next, saying a big, big thank you to Governor Cuomo along the way, of course, but also showing pieces of this climate film that is new, brand new stuff. Nobody's seen it. It's going to be exciting. So if you want us to come to, we're looking at trying to get, you know, 40 cities, New York and Pennsylvania, in February and March, really like a whistle stop tour. So hopefully, you know, we'll sign up at Solutions Grassroots and stay tuned. And if you want us in your town, send us an email.
That sounds fantastic. I hope everyone will do it. I look forward to seeing it in Brooklyn when it comes here. And seeing the new clips of the film. Thank you so much. And listeners, if you haven't seen Gasland 1 and 2, catch up. It's time. This is not something happening anywhere else, but it's in your backyard, wherever you are in this country or in this world. This affects all of us, so you can catch up by going to Gasland Movie, isn't it? .com,
yes.
The original website, and catch up and see both films. First one is the one with the famous water faucet on fire, but it's a lot more than one homeowner's water faucet, as dramatic and compelling and actually true as that image is. Thank you so much for being with us today, and thank you for all the work you do, Josh. It's just terrific, inspiring. It gives us hope and it gives us strength to continue to do what we must. And thank you for being with us on Connect the Dots. It's been great having you here. Stay with us over the break. We'll be coming back with the second part of Connect the Dots and talking to someone who's been on the ground in Pennsylvania and really can report on what's going on there and what it's like to be there, as Josh Fox was just describing for us. So please stay with us for the second half of Connect the Dots.
There was me, there was the sky, and there is a tree that crawled alive. Um,
Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. Thank you for staying with us for the whole program. If you're just tuning in, you can find the entire show in the Connect the Dots archives later this afternoon and going forward, and listen to the show in its entirety. If you've been enjoying the show and listening all along, please remember to like us on iTunes and pass us along to friends who might be interested in learning more about this topic. For the second half of the show, I'm so happy to have with us today Vera Scroggins. She is an activist and an advocate and someone who has been really a pioneer. I consider her actually a reporter on the ground in Pennsylvania, in the very regions that we've been hearing about from Josh Fox in the first half of the show, where fracking has really taken over and dramatically changed people's lives, their homes, their communities, their landscape, their water, and so much more. So in this half of the show, we're going to be hearing from Vera Scroggins. Vera is an absolutely extraordinary person. As I said, I consider her a citizen journalist because, you know, the press and the major media was really slow in getting onto understanding the complexities and dangers of fracking, as were many governments, state and local and national. And so really citizens and neighbors and people had to sort of step up and fill in the gaps, become informed. We were talking about that with just Josh Fox in the earlier part of the show. And Vera has been a leading light and a real pioneer in the Pennsylvania regions in northeastern Pennsylvania that have been so badly afflicted. So I'm honored to welcome you to Connect the Dots, Vera Scroggins. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Allison. Thank you for that introduction. And I'm happy to be here to expose as much as I can about all that we are going through since 2008.
Well, you know, in the first half of the program, Josh was pointing out that while so many are celebrating, and rightly so, the ban against fracking specifically in New York, Pennsylvania has really been the poster child, the whipping boy, really, for the ill effects of the the fracking industry on local populations. Can you please tell our listeners, what you have seen in the time that you've been there and this whole boom has grown?
Well, I'm a resident of Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania. That's in the northeast part of Pennsylvania. We're a county of about 45,000 people. And we're a large county. It's about 830 square miles. And I moved here from Nassau County, Long Island, in 1991. So I've been here about 24 years. And in 2008, the industry entered, and I call it an invasion. They invaded our county in the southwestern part of the county in an area called Dimmock, which eventually became famous to be ground zero for the water contamination that occurred shortly after they started drilling. And what they're doing is, that's very shocking for me, coming from suburbia. And before that, I was raised in the urban Elizabeth in New Jersey, urban areas. I was shocked to see that we have basically no zoning in our rural areas, our rural counties of Pennsylvania, which means that they can put gas wells, compressor stations, treatment plants anywhere in our county outside of maybe a couple of boroughs, what they call towns, like the county seat. Otherwise, it's all 90%, 95% is country. So they can put it anywhere next to homes, on school properties, on farms where food is produced. And so they started in 2008 to drill the first wells, gas wells, and within a month or two, contamination started and people started noticing some of them, not everybody, but a certain percentage noticed their water changing. It started to either change color or have an odor or start to bubble and spritz out of their faucets. It started to make them sick or dizzy when they took a shower. They might have rashes on their skins in reaction to whatever was in there. So that started the process, and now we have 7 sections in our county that have water contamination. Citizens complain that I know of, and there could be more. We are up to 1,100 gas wells. That means holes that are dug throughout our county. They started in the southwest, endemic in there, and then it started to spread like an army or like a virus, I sometimes say. And it spreads from the east to the west to the north until it's filling up most of the county. And this is only 25% developed in about 6 years. And not only do we have 1,100 gas wells, we also have almost 1,000 DEP, which is our Department of Environmental Protection in Pennsylvania, almost 1,000 DEP violations just in my county. So I'm just talking about my county. There's 22 counties that are being developed in the state of Pennsylvania. And we're one of the top developed ones as far as how many wells we have. And then besides all that, then the infrastructure started to develop. We had no idea what was going to happen. The farmers who signed those leases, and most of the people signed leases with the gas companies, had no idea what was going to happen. They were told something totally different, and then when this started to develop and expand, the footprint is so massive that it takes on almost every aspect of your town, because you have to have treatment plants. You have to have storage facilities. You have to have compressor stations every 2 to 4 miles to compress this gas and shoot it out of endless amounts of hundreds of miles of high-pressure pipelines that have been put in of all different sizes, anywhere from 12 inches up to, now they're proposing, 42 inches in our county. So it's a massive industrial development of a rural area and what I consider residential areas where people live. So it can be within hundreds of feet of your home, and it can be, you can be surrounded by it. I have friends who are surrounded by gas wells whose water has been contaminated. They haven't been able to use it for 5 or 6 years, and they have to use replacement water.
What happens? I mean, where does this, where do they get water from?
Well, we have a municipality, a county seat called Montrose. They have a lake called Lake Montrose, and they have a treatment plant, a small treatment plant that's owned by Pennsylvania American Water. This treatment plant uses the lake water, treats it with lots of chlorine, and that feeds into the town of Montrose that gets this water through a piping system. They get piped in water. They don't have water wells, while the rest of us, most of the county has private, we have private water wells or springs. So they get that replacement water from the municipality. They have to buy it either privately or the industry supplies it. So it's a combination.
So they're going to have to, if they stay there, they have to purchase water for the rest of their natural days, or the industry trucks in what's called a water buffalo, which is an enormous, I mean, it's as big as a kind of a quarter of a garage, I would say. I mean, how big is a water buffalo? They truck these things in, and they have water in them then to give the house.
Well, it varies because all different sizes, from about 300 gallons to 1,100 gallons. So it depends how many people are in your family, in your home. If you have a lot of people, then they give you 1,100 gallons. And it can fit, I guess it can fill up about a half of a one-car garage, but it's most of the time it's outdoors in sheds and has to be heated, and the landowner, the homeowner, has to pay for the extra electricity to heat these in the winter, which can run anywhere from $100 to $200 extra a month just to heat that so it doesn't freeze. And you have a pump in there. The pump moves the water from the water buffalo into your housing, into the pipes, into your home, so that you can then open your faucet, get the water out. And this is just for household use. Anything in the water buffalo is not potable, is not for drinking. It's just for household use.
So then so what
your
do they
drinking
drink?
Water
what
has to come from drink? Bottled water.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's an added expense also, whether you have to do it privately or the industry has been ordered by the DEP to provide it for you, which happens for a number, like for endemic people, they were ordered to provide water. DEP ordered Cabot Oil and Gas to provide water for 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm. And then what happens? The water, then they're on their own after they're done.
Then they're on their own. They were on their own. They took settlements, a bunch of them. Lawsuits are abounding throughout our county besides the state of Pennsylvania. So there were settlements with Cabot Oil and Gas. And then most of the times when there's a settlement, there's what they call a gag order or a non-disclosure that requires the person not to speak about their case, their settlement, what has happened to their water.
So that the next person that is being told, oh, this is all fine and no problem, their neighbor can't clue them in, or the people in the next town or the next county can't say anything to them because they would then be in violation of their gag order. And so then the next group of people will be signing up for this, not really fully understanding what all of the results of it could be. That's pretty terrible. Let's talk a little bit about also what you have been doing, because I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
You have been the person who, and this is why I call you a reporter, I mean, you were doing two things. One is that you were documenting this with a little mm-hmm. video camera, you know, and the other thing is you were taking people on tours so that people from outside the area could begin to understand the terrible effect on people's lives and communities of this. And so let's just talk a little bit about what you were, and then ultimately the gas companies became, didn't want you or anyone to be kind of showing what they were up to. So then they tried to block you in court. So let's talk a little bit about, first, what you were doing, and second, you know, what their efforts have been to try to stop you from doing it.
Yes, I've been since 2008 when I first heard about it, and I was shown the first rig on two farms in Dimmock by a friend of mine who lives there, mm-hmm. and I was shocked when I saw it, so I started to videotape, which I'm into. I'm a videographer, you know, just amateur, and mm-hmm. I was part of independent media in Binghamton, New York. I'm near Binghamton, New York, you know, our county.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned how to use a camera. You learned how to use software, editing software, and how to upload movies, videos on YouTube. So I started to document and also keep a journal and write mm-hmm. letters and write about it and give testimony. So I started that in 2008. And then eventually in 2009, I decided to, someone asked me to give a tour. To give mm-hmm. a tour and to show them what I see when I go around looking at the different sites, what have I seen, and to be able to help them see. So I started that in 2009, and now it just escalated over. It escalated over the years, and it became something that is almost happening every week. So mm-hmm. I've shown hundreds of tours, hundreds of people, and to let them see, especially those from New York, and they come from all over the world and other parts of the United States and Pennsylvania, to let them see what we are living with, what's next to homes, on school properties, on farms, and see if this is what they want. And 98% of the people, when they see it, they're pretty much shocked, and they do not want this for their neighborhoods or their communities.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been doing that, and then at some point, I guess it was 2013, I was doing a lot of legislators, especially from New York, a lot of media, elected officials, citizens, showing them around, and then Cabot Oil and Gas, which is one of seven companies in our county. We have seven mm-hmm. gas companies. Now I think we're down to six. We might be down to five because they're starting to, one of them just sold their assets, their leases, that they pulled out of our county. Another one is talking about selling their leases and pulling out. So they're having financial problems, economic problems. So Cabot, the largest one, who leases about 40% of our county, and the one that I showed the most, because they're the ones that contaminated Dimmock. They're the ones that have DEP violations, the most violations, almost 600 of them. They're mm-hmm. the ones that have a special 9-square-mile moratorium or ban in the Dimmock area where they cannot drill or frack since 2010 because of the contamination and the high methane levels. that had been released because of their gas drilling. So at some point, Canada felt it was too much. And instead of just asking me not to either come on their property or drive up the access road, send me a letter, they decided to go straight to the judge, the county judge, and ask for an emergency injunction to keep me a certain distance from their driveways, which they call access roads, on the public roads, and to keep me a certain distance from their site, even if I am on private property where I have permission to be. So the judge granted it to them after hours of cross-examination and discussion, and I was not allowed for 5 months to step on any part of their leased property, which included most of, like 40% of the county, all kinds of businesses, homes of friends of mine, people that I know. So I had to stay in the public road at that point and not step on their property. And then attorneys
I don't
came
understand
forward.
Something, Vera. Let me just ask a question here. Sure. If you're on at the home of a friend, their private property, then how can you be on a friend's private property? How can that be construed to be Cabot's private property?
Well, because Cabot, whether they've leased them or not, it doesn't matter. But because Cabot has asked for 100-foot, right now I'm under my second injunction, which has been modified. So I have to stay 100 feet from their site and 100 feet from their driveway. So if someone, let's say your next-door neighbor has a gas site, and I happen to know the person next door, and they say, you can come on my property and photograph and bring people to take a look, which I do. I have to stay 100 feet away from the edge of their site. And that 100 feet can go into the next-door neighbor's property where I have permission.
I see.
So they're controlling not only where they are on that property, they're controlling it can be into the next property also. Plus, if it's a driveway from a public road, which they're from public roads, they're also controlling where I can stand from the driveway. I have to stand 100 feet away from that driveway. Everybody else can come closer except myself. So if I bring a whole group with me, they can come closer, but I cannot. So
well,
I have this special injunction that's the only one that we know of in the state of Pennsylvania against the citizens and possibly in the United States in relationship to the fossil fuel industry.
That's chilling in light of, the upcoming trade treaties, which I've reported on a great deal on this show. We have a whole month of programming on that was done in May 2014, and it's suspected that in the coming weeks this may be coming up for a vote in Congress, and this would give if kind of sent through Congress, these treaties, if approved, would give corporations, both domestic and international, the right to supersede American law if they if they said that certain laws or regulations were lowering their profits. It's a little and part of the problem with the TPP is we don't know what the actual provisions are because those are being kept secret too. When you hear what you have endured in terms of, the rights of an individual company over an individual, over a community, and all the rest of it, it becomes chilling to think that that may be actually codified. When you recount what's happened to you, one could simply say, that's the state of Pennsylvania, I won't live there if I can control it, and too bad for all the people who do live there. But, this actually could become more common place anywhere in this country if some of these treaties go through. So you've kind of, it seems like it hasn't dimmed your efforts to, you keep going and bringing people. People still want to come and learn. And I would imagine that, they're seeing what really goes on, what this really is, has increased the fortitude of people who are opposing both the fracking and the fracking infrastructures, namely the pipelines, the compressor stations, all the stuff that carries the gas here, there, and everywhere. Even many communities where there won't be fracking will still have those infrastructures. Can you talk a little bit just for a minute or two to our listeners about, you know, what the infrastructures are. Are they just a walk in the woods if you don't have fracking in your area, or are they problematic as well?
Well, the infrastructure is, we have 40 compressor stations right now in one county, my county and county. That means every 2 to 4 miles there's a complete industrial complex facility. It looks like a small refinery, and it can be anywhere from like 3 acres to 60 acres. So they vary in size from 3 compressors to 12 on a site. So you have that scattered throughout the county, and it's like off, could be off main roads, side roads, across from homes, and people are listening to constant industrial noise within a mile of these sites, at least, that these are operating 24/7, and they put out constant industrial noise that's annoying and disturbing, because you don't want to hear that all the time, like an engine running. And then they have tons of toxic emissions, about 10 different emissions that are toxic and carcinogenic, and they're spewing that into the air. They're allowed tons of it per year, of VOCs, of VTEXs and benzenes and toluenes and nitrous oxides and formaldehydes, and the list just goes on. So we're being exposed to that, too. Now our air quality is being degraded, and we are having that health issue and risk being foisted on us against our will. So it's not that we've approved these sites, and this is just proliferating throughout the county. So this is a problem. So anywhere they are, they're going to want this. So whether they have gas pads or compressor stations, pipelines, whether you're fracking or not, you will have the infrastructure in your state. And it's not a good thing. It's risky. We've had 5 leaks and explosions of gas in these stations the past 2.5 years, and explosions and fire has damaged parts of the buildings and the compressor station. So far, no one's been hurt, but we've had to endure that also, living near it.
Really, so it sounds just hellish.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's a problem, and they're only 25% developed. So they keep on going. They're not even fully developed yet. They're not fully done in our county.
So they begin with some of these things, and then they keep building it out and building it out and building it out more. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, this is going through New York State, even though there's a fracking ban. It'll go through Massachusetts, through Connecticut, through New England. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's why people are protesting all over. As they learn about it all over our country, they're trying to stop the XL pipeline. People are going through people's properties and bringing that crude through. We have spills almost on a daily, several days a week basis. I just heard about another one in Montana today. 50,000 gallons of oil spilled at the Yellowstone River or something. I mean, this is a regular thing and being reported throughout our country, besides the world where they are, you know, oil and gas. And now BP, it was announced, is going to be fined by a judge after they've had a civil court suit that it can be fined up to $18 billion for all the damage they did. And meanwhile, our President Obama and others, of course, in BP, told us there was nothing to be concerned about. They were cleaning up this mess, and then you can still swim in the Gulf, and there's nothing to worry about. Now it's coming out. There's been a long court lawsuit, and billions in fines are going to be leveled on this company. So, and this is considered the worst spill in our history, is the BP Gulf spill.
Mm-hmm.
So we are having these things all over the country. Fossil fuels pollute. We got to get that through our heads. They are risky. They are dangerous. We need to get off of them completely and go to renewables that do not pollute and contaminate and risk our lives. So that's the main issue, and that's what all the people of this country need to gather together in solidarity and force this and insist on it in our government, local, state and federal, to have this transition and let go of this dirty fossil fuel energy that we do not need any longer.
Thank you, Vera. That's fantastic. We're, you know, that really sums it up. And that's really for listeners everywhere, because it's not just happening in you know, it's happening in Vera's neighborhood, but it's coming to all our neighborhoods, all our air, water, and earth. And it's something that should concern everyone, and we have to do something about it. Thank you again, and again and again and again, Vera Scroggins, for the, you know, for being on Connect the Dots, and more importantly, for the incredible yeoman's work you've been doing for the last 6+ years and continue to do today, even when under, you know, these kinds of injunctions, and for your hard work, your persistence. You know, you are a true heroine, and you know, and role model for all of us in this time. You know, I'm really grateful you could join us on the show. I'd love to have you back again. Meanwhile, listeners, you know, please do go to solutionsgrassroots.nationbuilder.com, where you can find more about the Solutions Project. It's going to be going through New York and Pennsylvania in February and March. If you do live in any of those areas, or, you know, if your area is under risk, you can connect with people who can tell you and be role models for, you know, how to organize and what to do about it. Thank you, Vera, and, you know, more blessings and power to you for the incredible work you're doing for your community and for all of us.
No, you're welcome. You're welcome, and I'll continue to do it despite the injunctions. I'll keep going. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you, listeners, for being with us today and Connect the Dots for another edition of our program. Please pass this along to your friends. Take action. Get involved. And see you next week. We'll be back here on Progressive Radio Network at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on Wednesdays with Connect the Dots. Have a great week. Be healthy. I'm Allison Rose Levy, wishing you all the best.
Oh,